I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Is Thursday, April 4th, and we're going to start out with a public hearing on House Bill 3447. Open that hearing. Bob, would you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3447 requires a person conducting floral business operation to disclose the physical location of their principal place of business in any advertising, prohibits misrepresentation of the principal place of business in advertising or otherwise, and makes that misrepresentation an unlawful trade practice.
Thank you. Could we have Representative Kumpf?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Holby and committee members. It's my pleasure to come before your committee today, first time this session. For the record, my name is Betty Kumpf, and I represent House District 22, which is Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. What I want to do today is do a very, very brief introduction because I have two presenters that will share the issue much better, more thoroughly than I can, although I will stay to respond to questions. And House Bill 3447 has gone through, we've done a lot of work on this, including months of work groups with national florists, local florists, and been dealing with this issue for about 6 years. And the reality is our local florists have been losing business because of the capacity in the past that big florists, national florists, misrepresent their location, and that people do an internet search to order flowers, and they find out that later that the flowers they ordered aren't as a comparable bouquet that they thought, and it's costing them a lot more, and all the profits are going to out-of-state companies. And the other part of this is it's creating unnecessary fees and payments on our local businesses. I want to propose, would like to introduce, if it's all right with the chair, my local florist, Cindy Wernier Kelly, and she has owned her shop for 23 years. And these deceptive advertising practices have been happening in the floral industry for a long time. And we passed legislation previously about fraudulent practices. And we have Dr. Keith Hill, who is one of the biggest florists in the state for Beaverton Florist. Dr. Hill is a second-generation florist, and the family has owned and operated the Hill family business for 48 years, and he's been integral. Both of these people have carried the weight on this issue. I am going to turn the microphone over to them. You will be hearing from the national florist industry through a couple of folks later on in this hearing. And I would share that I would gratefully request, and it's been a long time since I've done this, that you change an amendment here in committee rather than going through the amendment process, but I'll do what the chair decides on this. The amendment that's going to be proposed would do a civil penalty in the amount of $250 if they are cited, and this is done through our Department of Justice. And it's my feeling that $250 by no means would cover the cost that our Justice Department would go through to research and a complaint and issue a citation. So I would ask for a $5,000 figure there that more relates to the actual cost for our department. Yes, a representative, I see that great look on your face. But what I would share is, and you know what, maybe you don't know if you haven't worked with an attorney lately in any private issues, but a $5,000 amount is a good deal because it's usually going to cost you a lot more. And we want to make sure whether it's Boley or the Justice Department that this is not, this bill is not going to impact them with a loss of revenue.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, can we go ahead and have Keith Hill and Linda?
Cindy Wardiner Kelly.
Yes. Hard to read the writing.
They're pros at this.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would introduce yourself before you speak to the bill, please.
My name is Lucinda Wardinger Kelly. I'm the owner of Valley Pacific Floral Incorporated. My address is 1537 Mount Hood Avenue, Suite 103, Woodburn, Oregon, 97071. And I'd like to thank you all for allowing us this time. And I know PowerPoint presentations can be boring, but I'll make it really fast. I've done it a couple times, so we'll get through it. Thank you for sponsoring Representative Comp, our legislation, and this is a picture of my homepage website, and as you can see, I clearly have Valley Pacific Floral and Woodburn Florist listed at the top. If you go to the About Us page, you can see I have my address and phone numbers listed with the area code 503. On the homepage, again, I have my address listed and the telephone number. Here I've done a Google search for Flowers Woodburn, Oregon, and this flower shop came up, woodburnfloristtoday.com. So you can see they're using the name Woodburn Florist, and they also have a 503 telephone number. And it's very confusing for the consumer that goes on the website. They think they want to send flowers to Woodburn, and they look and they see this company, and they think, oh, well, there's Cindy's shop, woodburnfloristtoday.com. If I click on this website, you can see they have made a website that looks similar to mine with Woodburn Florist on it, and they've also purchased a 503 phone number. If we go to the About Us page, they nowhere have their address listed anywhere on it. They have, again, Woodburn Florist plastered all over it, making it seem like they deliver local with the 503 phone number. Here we go to the Contact Us, I think it's the About Us page, and they have gone so far as to take a Google map of Woodburn, and it has an intersection of where my flower shop is. When I saw this come up, I called the phone number, the 503 phone number, and the clerk on the other end answered it. I believe it was Flower Shop Concierge. And I posed as a consumer, and I said, hey, I'm here in Woodburn, and I need to send flowers, but I can't see. I'm looking on your website exactly where the pinpoint is of your address, of your location. What is your address? Well, she was all prepared to walk me through the website to take my order. And when I pushed her on the fact of, well, what's your address, she types on the computer a minute, and she comes back on, and she says, 1537 Mount Hood Avenue. Okay, well, that's my address. And she was all ready to take me through the website to take my order when I started laughing. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I could see the map and all of the 503 phone number and that she took my name, but to take my address too and then try to steal my business, I'm like, okay, I just started laughing, and I'm like, how can you do that? It's my phone. That's my address. By the way, this happened in December. Okay, so it's very recent, still going on. Anyway, when she finds out I'm the owner of the real shop, she hangs up on me, and I couldn't get any more information. After doing a little bit of research, I found out that they were actually a company located in Florida, and they had hundreds of phone numbers and fictitious websites created for every small town in Oregon. Aurora Florist Today, Beaverton Florist Today, Hillsboro Florist Today, all over. I've filed complaints for the last 7 years with the Department of Justice about cases just like this, but they could not prosecute them because the first legislation that we had written was geared towards the phone books, and it worked great. If you look today, there's hardly any companies in there that do not put their address on their website, I mean on their listing in the phone book. this legislation will require them to put their address on their front page of their website, not in small print on the About Us page, but actually on the home page of the website. So we're not deterring business from Oregon. We're just saying, look, if you want to advertise in Oregon, that's fine, but you're going to do it without tricking the consumers. Okay? So all we're asking is that they put their address on the home page. We don't think that's too much. Also, it addresses the fact that they're using our business names, which we have registered to the Department of Commerce here in Oregon. They just use them without any permission whatsoever. It also will make them, require them to not be able to use a 503 phone number if they're out of state. It's not saying they can't use their 800 numbers. That's what 800 numbers were created for. That way the consumer knows that it's toll-free. They can still use it and not have to pay, but they're not tricking them into knowing that they're thinking that they're in Oregon when they're not. This particular flower shop here, Ava's Flowers, we did a Google search for Send Flowers Woodburn, Oregon. And you can see here they have two listings, two ads, one on the right side of the column. If you also look on the right side of the column, you'll see a listing for 1-800-Flowers. You'll see a listing for Valley Pacific Floral, which is actually me. You'll see a listing for teleflora.com. And down below, you'll see a listing for FTD. Those three out-of-state companies are the companies that this amendment is written for. They're writing them for these three big corporations that you can see. They're also order gathering in Woodburn, Oregon. If you go to Ava's homepage, there's no address, but there clearly is a Google map, again, pinpointing Woodburn. And they took the name Best Woodburn Florist, or Woodburn, Oregon Florist Flower Delivery. No address. Again, we did another Send Flowers Woodburn, Oregon search, and we came up with this company, which is actually Flower Delivery Express. These huge companies are out of state, and they have different company names all over the United States. What's the other one for this one? Just Flowers?
From You Flowers.
From You Flowers. If we go to their About Us page, they have all these zip codes of major hospitals listed for Oregon, and they have, for Woodburn, they have the funeral homes. The administrative clerk should have handed you two letters that I could not get the consumers that had complaints to come in to testify because they're elderly. Well, one of them's elderly. But she, both of them, one has been duped on the internet, the other one was duped on the telephone pages. So if the amendment goes through, it's going to deface the first piece that we've already passed, which is working beautifully. It's working awesome. If this amendment goes through, it's going to take the wind out of that one, because these companies, once the yellow pages are printed, that ad is in there for a full year. So $250, whoop-de-doo, these companies are making millions. In this one particular letter that the consumer wrote, she was at a funeral service, accidentally bumped onto one of these phone numbers that claimed they were Woodburn. And when she got to the service, she saw this little tiny dinky flower bouquet, and she paid $79, I think it was. And she was embarrassed, okay? Well, she immediately comes to my shop because she thinks I delivered it. I'm like, I'm sorry, but that was not ordered to my shop. And when we researched it through her credit card statement, we found out that the company was actually in Wisconsin. There were two other people at the same funeral service that had this happen to. So that's just to give you an idea. I'm a small town, a very small flower shop in a small town in Woodburn, Oregon. One funeral service, three orders. Can you imagine the amount of money that's leaving the state in this industry because we're not requiring these companies to stop deceiving the consumer?
I think you've made your point very well.
Yeah.
And I don't really think you need to go on. Unless somebody has questions for you, I think it seems rather egregious to me.
Can I just really quick show you this letter from the Department of Justice? They sent me this letter. I've sent them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of complaints over the years. This letter they sent, and they, in the very last sentence, they said, "We do not believe the way the statute is written that we can enforce it against internet websites. It appears the statute did not address websites." That's why I'm here today. And I got this letter in 2011. This is how long I've been working on it. The governor vetoed this other piece of legislation that we tried to get together because we were going at it from, rather than from consumer protection, we were trying to regulate these big three order gathering companies, which Mr. Gardner is representing. And we were not able to do that, so he vetoed it. So he put a task force together, which Keith was on, Mr. Gardner was on, FTD Teleflora, all of their attorneys were on. We wrote a beautiful piece, which is the one we have here. And now, at the last hour, they're trying to deface it. And they want to make it a $250 fine because the Department of Justice needs the $25,000 to stop it, because if they have to take one of these companies to court, they have millions and millions of dollars, and $250 isn't worth their time. So that's why we really need for this to go forward as is and not with the amendment.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Would you like to make any comments or?
1 minute. My name is Keith Hill. I used to practice dentistry, and now I'm a flower shop owner. Located in Beaverton, Oregon. We have had the privilege of, for many years, being one of the largest shops in the state of Oregon. We have 20 employees, and I can tell you that from a large shop perspective, this legislation is needed not only to protect the small towns from this egregious behavior, but if you want to send flowers to a small town, say mom and dad live in Woodburn, Oregon, if there's no shops left because these deceitful order gatherers have run them out of business, how are you going to get flowers there? That's one point of it that I wanted to make. And the other one is that we have actually formed a nationwide group called Florists for Change, who are trying to change this industry. The way it was set up in 1910 with FTD, it worked great. The problem was that with the advent of the internet, it changed the entire dynamic, and all the money is being made by those people who are taking the orders and not filling the orders.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Any questions from the committee? I think this presentation was pretty self-explanatory. Certainly highlighted the problem.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. I just am curious if this happens in other industries that you know of.
It does happen in the locksmith industry, and there's a company in Wilsonville Lock and Security, and if you Google search it, same thing. And I've been in contact with him, and I told him that if I get this passed, that I'm going to forward the piece to him so he can work on his industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you bringing this back to us after we thought we tried to fix the floral issues for you before and were unsuccessful.
Well, it's just always changing. So, yeah.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Comp. Up next, I have Jim Gardner and Gary Oxley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. Gary is, I believe, detained in another committee at the moment, so I will represent our position. We represent FTD, Teleflora, and 1-800-Flowers, which are the major floral order facilitators operating in the United States and internationally. And those of you with a bit of a memory may recall that a version of this legislation was passed previously that included not merely the what I would call the consumer protection elements of it, which we favor, but also a price control element. And that was the bill, the one and only bill during Governor Kitzhaber's third term that he actually vetoed on the advice of the Attorney General because, first, it was clearly unconstitutional under both the Commerce Clause and the clause that that prohibits the legislature from impairing contracts.
So, to this bill.
But I'm just getting to that, Mr. Chair. This bill is really in response to the governor's admonition in his veto message that we come up with a method of dealing with the problem, which was outlined just a moment ago, which is consumer deception. That's the sort of the pathway we were on. The amendment that you are looking at, we would submit for your consideration. It is based on a national model that has been adopted in California. It does not abrogate the existing provision that is listed in lines 6 through 11 on page 1 of the bill. It retains that, unlike actually the bill the original bill that you're looking at. We actually retain the current provision that was referred to, which I think the witness testified has been effective in terms of deterring the practice of telephone misrepresentation, telephone book misrepresentation. So we are retaining that. We're suggesting that the language in the dash ones is more succinct and also, again, comports with national model legislation. We think there is a problem. It's a problem that of people misrepresenting the location of their business. And we think the dash ones deal with that adequately.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Gardner? Representative Doherty.
Okay. Do the dash one amendments deal with the issue that was brought before us before that that there's, you know, on the websites and these kind of things that it really does not? I mean, it shows, you know, the locality of your shop. Does that deal with the fraud that's being perpetrated through that?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Be specific as to where in the.
Yeah, Doherty, I believe it does. If you look on page 2. Lines 4 through 5, the name of the business misrepresents the provider's or vendor's geographic location, and then lines 6 through 8 does not identify the true physical address.
Okay.
Thank you. And I know this is the first time the committee's seen the amendment, and we're definitely not going to move forward with this, but we're going to take a close look at this and have some discussions, and we'll see what we'll do with this. Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3447. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3169. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 3169.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3169 allows a contracting agency to meet their green energy technology requirement using energy generated away from the site of a public building if that green energy technology meets certain qualifications. It requires a contracting agency to collect and maintain certain information and to report that information each quarter to the Department of Energy, and it requires the department to deliver an annual report to the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you. So could I have Diana Enright?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diana Enright, and I work for the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm here to talk about the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3169, which revises the requirements to public improvement contracts so they can meet the 1.5% green energy technology obligation. As written, the department can implement House Bill 3169. The department has submitted Dash 2 amendments to the bill for the purpose of clarifying two areas of the bill. The amendment addresses how to determine new green energy technology and provides guidance for conducting cost comparisons when developing new green energy technology. Green energy technology means a system that employs solar or geothermal energy directly for space or water heating or to generate electricity. As written, the bill requires that state monies used for constructing green energy technology, either on-site or off-site, must fund new green energy technology that does not replace existing. So the two clarifications we've submitted is for the Dash 2 amendments, one of them sets a point in time for establishing new green energy technology. For solar, new is a system which is added after the date of issuance of the original building permit. For geothermal, construction of new capacity is that which has been completed on or after January 1st of 2013, which is the effective date of Senate Bill 1533 that was passed in 2012. The Dash 2 amendment also provides direction for cost comparisons. The contracting agency will compare like technologies. So they will compare solar to solar, on-site and off-site, and geothermal to geothermal, on-site to off-site. This will help eliminate any complex cross-technology comparisons they might have to do. And those are the simplifications we'd like to see. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
And I'd like you to clarify one thing. As the original underlying bill was brought forward to help clarify existing statute around geothermal that was passed to, add geothermal to the ability to use for this requirement. The background of that, so many of the committee may not know the background of this bill that's already existing law.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. As we were going through rulemaking for Senate Bill 1533, a number of things came to our attention, and so that's what we're trying to do are some technical fixes.
Thank you. With that, questions from the committee? I know it's the first time we've seen this, and it's going to take the committee probably a little bit of time to review this one, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. Oh, Representative Vega Peterson.
Yeah, I have a question, Chair, and I'm not sure if maybe you would be the right person to answer it or you would, but so what we're seeing in an energy environment is kind of a tendency to move away from being specific about which technology we're referring to, and this bill refers to two very specific technologies, but doesn't leave room for a change in technology in the future. So is there a reason why we're being so specific about the technologies in this bill?
Yeah, that's a good $100 question at least. And the original bill that was passed was about on-site solar applications and came about with the advent of solar technology and manufacturing growing in the state. And I speak to that because I was here when that legislation was introduced and passed. And so it was pretty much aimed at solar has some unique properties that other technologies did not. And subsequent to that bill coming forward, there was some a lot of interest for using geothermal in some of the areas of the state where in Eastern Oregon primarily where we have a lot of geothermal, of being able to get credit for using geothermal in this same aspect. So that was pretty much the background of it. It was originally an on-site solar initiative that came about with the same time the legislature and the governor's office were and ODO were looking for a goal of 25% renewables, and so this was a piece of that initial effort. Did I describe that correctly?
Mr. Chair, you did. It began in 2007, like you said.
Thank you. So I have a couple more testifiers to come up, Mark Landauer and Jeff Bissonnette. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Special districts have 950-some-odd members throughout the state of Oregon, providing a variety of different single-service provisions of service for citizens across the state. We'd like to thank Chair Holvey and the Department of Energy for the Dash 2 amendments. We are in support of those amendments. They do help clarify some issues that have come up in the past, and we think that the amendments will certainly improve the bill. In particular, clarifying what new technology is and, of course, how to conduct cost comparisons. For very small districts, this can be a difficult bill or law to work their way through, and we believe that the Dash 2s will make it somewhat easier for particularly those small, perhaps less sophisticated districts to comply with the current statute. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Jeff, would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. And I also work on behalf of the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, which is a statewide collaboration of public interest entities, organizations, and clean energy businesses. To answer Representative Vega Peterson's question, that was really the group and the coalition that backed the original 1.5% for solar back in 2007, as Chair Hovey said, in conjunction with the renewable portfolio standard of 25% by 2025. And so our main interest here is, as we worked with the chair and with other interested parties to add geothermal for some specific applications that look possible in different parts of the state, did that. Our main interest was making sure that the impetus for solar was not significantly undermined, I think that we achieved that, but in the rulemaking, it became pretty clear that in the rush of the 2012 short session, there were some clarifications that we really did need to make, and so that's the impetus behind this effort. The Dash 2s are looking pretty good. I had written up another set of amendments that are probably the Dash 3s that apparently haven't made their way here from LC, but I do know that I had a hallway conversation with folks from ODO, and they're looking at that and say, there's probably a way we can get to, just making sure that everybody's getting what they want through this, and we're happy to take part in that discussion and look forward to coming back and reporting on that process for you.
Thank you, and it may not be either one of you that can answer this, and maybe ODO, are they still here? Can answer this. I believe that, especially deferring to Mark Landauer's comments, that as far as the small public agencies, that this bill is mainly applicable to projects that use state funds, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed, but of course, the definition of state funds can be interpreted rather broadly. So, if I may, Chair Holvey, there are a number of districts that do receive funds from, example, the state revolving funds for clean water or for drinking water, what have you. Depending on the definition of what you call state funds, the provisions of this current statute could or may not kick in. There may be some need for further definitional work on what state funds are on this, and I'd be happy to participate in any discussions around that. But certainly other funds, the state public works projects, for example, certainly could be another example of state funds that could trigger this requirement as well.
Thank you. I'd be happy to have that conversation with you. So do we have questions on this one? Not seeing any. Thanks for the presentation and getting this. And I was a little bit surprised this bill ended up in this committee, frankly. But we're gonna do our best with it. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3169. I'm gonna stand at ease just for a moment. We're back in session. We will be carrying over House Bill 2662. We won't be working that bill today. So just in case anybody's here for that one. So with that, I think we'll jump a little bit. I'm going to go to the end of the calendar and open a work session on House Bill 2929. And Bob, can you give us a brief description of House Bill 2929?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2929 is the measure that adds additional requirements for trustees in relation to foreclosure sales. The committee has previously adopted a dash 2 amendment to this measure on March 26th, and there is also a dash 4 amendment that the committee has, and we have someone here to speak to that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Can we have Tori Klein, please? Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tori Klein. I met you all or introduced myself to you once before. I'm an attorney from Eugene, Oregon. I've come today just to speak to the dash 4s that are now before you and answer any questions you have or explain how we got to the dash 4s if you would like to know how we got there.
Yeah, if you could just give us a brief little description of what the Dash 4 is.
But the Dash 4 is, you adopted the Dash 2s. Really, the Dash 4s are almost exactly the same. We just worked with a couple other people that needed some super technical fixes. Like, I believe the Dash 2s may have forgotten to include a portion of the current statute, which was not intended to happen. So, in effect, it would have omitted some of it. So they fixed that. And then a couple other people, I believed, worked with adjusting. I think it may have been just one reference to a statute. So the Dash 4 should look pretty similar to the Dash 2s, technically. And I believe there was one question about moving from the introduced bill to the Dash 2s. I'm not sure who asked that initially in the last work session, but I'm here to answer that question if it comes back up.
I don't what was that? Can you say that so Bob?
There was a question about the bills introduced at the last work session, getting to the Dash 2s, about, you'll notice in the Dash 2s and the Dash 4s that there's a lot of the meat or a lot of the information that was in the House bills introduced has been taken out in an effort to streamline and also hearing from DOJ about the enforcement mechanism. As an attorney, I'm all about practicality, so I believe we thought it's a good idea. We want to have more time to work on it with DOJ, with some of the enforcement needs of more of the, I guess you call it the sanctions section. So although it's a good idea, that has been stripped out, hopefully to work on for future sessions and move forward with that. I believe the relation back clause was also taken out. Once again, something just to streamline it to make sure we focus on at least one of the really important parts of the introduced bill.
And Ms. Klein, I'm hoping you can tell the committee what does this bill do at the end of the Dash 4 as amended. What does this bill accomplish?
At the end of the Dash 4 as amended, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it would do what we talked about the initial public hearing. It will make it so there's a 10-day limitation of rescission rights for trustees who sell a home at a foreclosure auction, which right now we know that number's down. We anticipate that ideally picking back up, and this is just a way where a trustee that sells a home at a foreclosure sale, they have 10 days to then rescind that sale to the purchaser, which aligns it with the purchaser's possessory rights. Within 10 days, they're allowed to take legal possession of the home, and also aligns it with current statute saying a trustee must deliver that trustee's deed that gives title within 10 days. So what it does, it expressly says either bring the trustee's deed to the purchaser, deliver that, or let them know you're going to rescind the sale, and then let them know why. And then it gives a time frame also to refund those monies, which we've seen not too often. Out-of-state trustees have been tempted to or have kept the money until legal battles have completed.
Thank you. So, questions, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually been involved in several of these. By no way am an expert on this. I'm trying to get my arms around how big of a problem is this? And I don't mean to be negative on this. Are we searching for a problem, or is this a problem?
It's a problem. It's a problem for. I wish we had. If we had another person up here that would be strictly representing consumer advocates, which are they're one group that we've had involved in all the amendments, and they strongly support this. I believe you have letters from a couple different consumer advocates. They could speak to a different reason why it's really important. I come with a business attorney hat on, saying that it is a problem we've experienced in our business where we've ended up spending thousands and thousands of dollars trying to get to out-of-state trustees that do keep the deeds for 15, 30, 120 days, attempt to rescind it. It's happened a couple times in our practice. Actual kind of covert rescission, which is what this is specifically talking to.
One last question, and I think this will help here.
Yeah.
Why would they want to rescind the deed?
Well, in the dash fours, and I believe in the dash twos, it talks about reasons for rescission, or if I were a trustee selling a home and I mistakenly sold it at a price that wasn't right, for whatever reason.
It's your sale.
Cheers. Excuse
me. Right, that's my...
Yes, so if I sold, and there are legitimate reasons, we've worked numerous times with trustees to then say, oh, we understand that was a much lower price than you, much lower price, 10% or something. As you know, foreclosure sales, there you do buy the homes for a much, much lower price than market value. That's usually the way it works out. But sometimes there are mistakes on the trustee's end where they're really low. And so we've worked with those people and said, okay, we'll make sure we don't anticipate getting the deed back. Those are things that aren't at issue because we're business, we aren't litigious, you know. So from the business consumer standpoint, that's there.
Can I ask one last question on this? Mm-hmm. And again, I think this might help a little bit.
Yeah.
So the folks who are impacted by this in these foreclosure sales, these aren't local banks going to the courthouse. These are large financial institutions who are out of state who are doing this in Oregon? Because, I mean, as a person who's dealing with the foreclosure, if I have a property I'm going to foreclose on, most likely I'm showing up to the courthouse, going to be on the steps and watch the transaction occur. I'm assuming these are companies somewhere else who are handing this off to someone else to say, take care of this.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, most of the time, I'll say all the time I've dealt with it, that's the case.
Interesting, okay.
They're out of state. The local trustees are very, very good with the way they function.
You convinced me.
Thanks.
Other questions, Representative Richardson?
Thank you. I'm concerned about, you know, if you sell by advertisement sale, okay, you foreclose by advertisement sale, you put the notices in. My recollection from the law is that the debtor has up until 5 days before the date of sale to pull out the property from the foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
This is saying, even though you're holding a foreclosure sale, within 10 days after the sale, you don't know if the foreclosure sale is good or not, because the party that's conducting the sale has the right to come in and nullify the sale because they found out that they didn't get enough for their own property. And it gives the debtor a 10-day right of redemption after the sale, because it says that if the creditor and the debtor make an agreement to avoid the foreclosure, then the foreclosure is invalidated as well. And so anyway, I'm trying to figure out why would this make sense to carve out a whole new policy where we're going to have rights of redemption for 10 days after a sale that takes place and give the one conducting the sale the right to say, oops, although I went to all the trouble and you guys came and you bid on this or whatever, mm-hmm. we can choose to nullify our own sale that we're conducting.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that make sense?
Well, two great things that you bring up that I can address, Mr. Chair and Representative Richardson. First, the idea of extending redemption rights. I've never once thought of that. My understanding with the way the dash fours are written, which may not be the way that they're practically applied from your perspective, is that it's not granting an additional redemption right period. What it's saying is that's one of the mistakes where they can, the bank
the trustee could say, oops, we were actually working with that debtor. We messed up. We conducted a foreclosure sale, and we shouldn't have. We have to rescind this. So that's one of the things, like mistake in opening bid or something.
Isn't that called malpractice? I mean, for lawyers? Just checking.
I don't represent banks. So. And then on your second point, though, you also talked about kind of that the what we I just wrote down the oops new right. It's not necessarily a new right. Of what I've seen in practice a lot, it's a current right. They just do it. They rescind the sales a lot. We work with them. The problems we've seen are the unilateral rescissions that occur a significant period of time after the date that they should have delivered the trustee's deed. So that's at issue. And so it's currently, since it was never expressly addressed, they've always just done it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I understand where you're coming from. Yeah. The vast majority of these sales go to the creditor. The creditor comes in and says, how much is owed on this? How much are our legal fees? We bid that amount. Is there anybody else here who would like to bid any more than that? Because we'd be happy to get out of the real estate business and get our money back.
Yeah.
And so usually that's the case, and this certainly protects them. But occasionally you have people that come in and they qualify to buy the property, and they say, you know, it's a $300,000 piece of property, and you're saying that the cost is $210,000, so I bid $211,000 because I want this property. Well, now, wait a second. The bank says, we had a bidder on this thing. So maybe we don't want to sell this one. We'll go and talk to that bidder and say, you know what, we're not going to sell it to you, but we would do it for $220,000 or $25,000. So if you are bidding at this sale because you thought that this was really a sale, it's not really a sale. It's just a disclosure that you would be interested, but the ones conducting the sale have the right to then nullify your bid by just saying, I got 10 days to say that I don't want to do this. And as far as making a mistake, that's why you hire lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. They'd go all through this, they check it out, and if they make that kind of mistake, then that's a claim against their malpractice insurance. You don't say, oops, this is to protect incompetent attorneys. So anyway, I would think that, now this is great for those that are specifically handling both sides of this transaction. It's not so good for a purchaser who comes to buy at an auction, which is the whole purpose of the auction. The whole idea of doing it on the steps, saying anybody that wants to buy or to offer in this, you know, can offer on it, including junior lien holders.
Right. But I think you have a response to that.
Well,
does not this already happen already? Because it's not, there's no law against nothing saying that they can't do this.
What I'll come back to saying is that it happens all the time. They rescind all the time. Already, for this law is important to what I'd say a larger consumer like the business I work for, because it says, fine, you do this, but you may not do it after 10 days. They already do it. If I wish I had a fix to say, you can't do this, you shouldn't have been doing it, but I don't know how we make the bill read that way. By saying you've never had this right, you don't have it in the future, and by us addressing it now, I don't feel like in practice it gives them that right to do it, that they have never done it before and now you have it. I don't think in practice that's the way it works. And on the other side of the coin, for consumers, there's a greater issue for a general consumer that like the debtor who has now just lost their home. I think you're speaking to that quite well. You understand the process, Representative Richardson. But there are other issues that this can attack of, you know, we're impacted 120 days later for rescission rights, as are they. So they know no matter what, this will never be rescinded at least 10 days later. And the reason there are specific reasons for rescission in the bill, I think they were put in there to address your concerns about why they'd simply rescind. Hopefully there's not collusion going on. I know we've never done that. I'm not saying that there probably isn't some somewhere, because I'm sure there is. Okay. But ideally, this is the best alternative.
So just a quick question to clarify in my own mind. Are you saying that currently this is being done, even though it's illegal for this to be done, and the way it's being done is by just not providing a trust deed after an auction takes place?
I can give you a long story about that.
How about a real short answer?
Yes.
So isn't that what we're trying to address?
Right.
I mean, I thought that's what this bill was about, was addressing those people that were not providing a deed within a reasonable amount of time, but now it's gone beyond providing the deed within 10 days. It seems to me that we're now changing a policy relating to how foreclosures are handled, right of redemption, essentially making deals, having the person or the entity that's conducting the sale have a unilateral right to undo a sale, and that just seems strange to me.
Well, may I speak to that, Chair Holvey? Representative Richardson, they've always, what I've seen in the last 2 years in the industry, they've always thought they had a unilateral right to rescind.
And I know.
That may be what we're trying to deal with.
I know, and we might, and I think in the first iteration of how it was introduced, and then the conversations I've had with a lot of different people, whether it's a lobbyist for title or some great trustees, local ones down in my town, or the consumer advocates, is we came up with a language hoping that this is the way to say, you can't rescind after 10 days. It addresses unilateral rescission, and it says you can only do it for X, Y, and Z, because I think there are certain cases where they should be able to rescind. If there was a really severe mistake, if they were dual tracking on accident, they should be able to rescind the sale because they shouldn't have foreclosed. That's listed. I can't tell you which subsection it is in that amendment. But
yeah, this is a... President Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me understand the enforcement piece.
Mm-hmm.
So we put this new statutory change in place, and at a foreclosure, nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
How does it get enforced?
There's a clear statutory requirement that's easier to deal with in the legal system than currently our statutes allow. That we would say you had an express right here, you didn't do that statutorily. It's an easier way to get attorney... terms,
so they're heading to court.
Yeah, in front of, because eventually it is a private right by a purchaser, a regular consumer. I know people that do this as a way to supplement their income on the side too. You know, the business, it's the same thing. The reason we came up with this and wanted to talk to consumer advocates about it also was because it was really, really difficult to get our money back. Really
okay.
Difficult, and we're a business.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, I'd like to go ahead and adopt the dash four, but not work the bill, and we'll maybe allow Ms. Klein to have some conversations with Representative Richardson for one, and several of us to answer some of our further questions about this. Representative Lively, could I have a motion on the dash four?
Sure. Chairman Hovey, I move the adoption of dash four amendments to House Bill 2929, dated 4313.
Representative Lively moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 2929 be adopted, dated 4313. I think we've had our discussion, but any other discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Representative Richardson noted. Objects. So with that, the dash four amendments adopted, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2929.
Thank you for your time.
Let's see.
Yes.
I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2207. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2207.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2207 is the measure that requires state payroll to be issued through direct electronic deposit. Requires the Department of Administrative Services to issue statements of deductions via email. There is a dash three amendment, and I believe we have someone here from the Department of Administrative Services to speak to that.
Oh, there he is. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and tell us what this bill does with the dash three amendments, and as briefly as you can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Barry Pack with the Department of Administrative Services. The dash three amendments reflect changes to the bill that will allow us to actually implement the intention of the bill After the bill was originally drafted, there were a couple of issues that were identified both internally among payroll staff and among representatives from organized labor around implementation of moving towards a more fully electronic distribution of payment and pay stubs. The Dash 3s make a couple of changes. First, it deletes the requirement that employees provide an email address to receive their pay stub. We prefer to keep a technology-neutral application, so the Dash 3s just say that we will provide pay stubs electronically. That allows us to have a secure website that an employee could log into just like you might at your bank to look at your accounts. That you'll receive your statement there rather than email, which obviously has some security questions. It also allows for paper checks to be processed, as the bill says, as practicable or efficient. We have to be able to process paper checks on hire. It takes a while to get direct deposit set up with a bank. Upon an employee leaving, their final paycheck needs to be issued immediately. It doesn't always fall on payday, so it needs to be paper. Part-time seasonal employees, if they're only here for a couple of weeks, you can't sign them up for direct deposit, so they'll need to receive paper paychecks. So we needed to make sure we left options for those to happen. And then upon the request of both AFSCME and SEIU, who expressed concerns that some employees, despite the 21st century, may still really want to receive a paper check and a paper pay stub, and they requested an option to opt out. And since we're going to have to maintain both systems anyway, for other reasons, it was fine with us to go ahead and do that. So the bill does allow for employees to opt out. The assumption of the bill is that all employees would receive payment and their pay stubs electronically. So it is a intentional opt out on the the onus is on the employee to choose to opt out, and we'll create a form that they would just fill out and sign upon hire or upon desire to change how they're receiving payment or pay stub. And then the final change on the bill requires agencies to provide computer access to employees that don't have regular access to a computer as part of their job. So if you're out in the field or out in the forest fighting a fire, you don't have a laptop with you. When you go back to headquarters, it'd be a kiosk available. Would be one way that we would envision an agency implementing this, so that the employee would have access then to their pay stub. They could look at it there, or they could print it at that time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Representative Smith, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with us, has there been any analysis in terms of potential fiscal savings to the state of Oregon as a result of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have done some preliminary analysis. What we've looked at this point is pure hard cost, so paper, envelopes, postage, right? Because currently every paycheck or pay stub gets printed, distributed to an agency. Someone at that agency probably either hands them out or folds them, puts them in an envelope, addresses them, mails them, or delivers them. So if you take into account those, we were looking at, I think, around, and this is a very rough preliminary estimate, of $360,000 biannually just in those hard costs alone.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up. And we'll be having that conversation with the co-chairs down in general government ways and means about
Mr. Chair,
savings on, so we can put them into education.
House Bill 2207 is intimately involved in a whole series of improving government initiatives that we will be happy to continue to have a discussion in that subcommittee around.
Appreciate you. Appreciate this, Chair Holby.
Thank you. And we don't know if there's a fiscal impact to this bill at this point. I don't believe.
Mr. Chair, we do not have the fiscal statement issued at this time.
Thank you.
Good bill.
Other questions? It may have a revenue impact for that matter. Thank you very much. I appreciate you laying out what we're looking at, and thank you for your work on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lively, I'd like a motion on the Dash 3 amendment.
Chair Hovey, I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2207, dated 4/1/13, be adopted.
Representative Lively moves the Dash 3 amendment to be adopted to House Bill 2207, dated 4/1/13. Discussion about this amendment? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the amendment is adopted. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2207 while we await more paperwork.
And next up, I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2824. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2824, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2824 clarifies that a tower may tow a motor vehicle that violates a prominently posted no parking sign that warns that parking is prohibited 24 hours a day or that parks next to a red or yellow curb. The committee has a proposed Dash 1 amendment that removes the provision for towing a motor vehicle parked next to a red or yellow curb.
Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I should note the measure has no revenue and no fiscal impact.
And so could you tell us, I know it was a very simple amendment, could you state that again, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll recall from the public hearing on this measure that there was concern about the clarity of the provision about what constituted next to a red or yellow curb, and the Dash 1 amendment simply deletes that reference from the original bill. So the measure would still change the existing statute to say specifically violation of a prominently posted no parking sign that warns that parking is prohibited 24 hours a day.
All right. Thank you. It's one way to get rid of a problem. So with that, Representative Blavick, I have a motion on...
Certainly. Chair Hovey, I move we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2824, dated 4-1-13.
Representative Lively moves that we adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2824, dated 4-1-13. Discussion on the amendment. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted. I believe, Bob, do we not have the fiscal and revenue impacts again with the amendment?
Mr. Chair, we have fiscal and revenue statements of no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the amended measure. It's ready to move.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2824 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2824 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion. Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2824, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And I think we'll put this one on the consent calendar. Any objection to the consent calendar, or somebody feel like we should explain this on the floor?
It gets pushback from some members.
You think?
I think
so. Okay. Would you like to carry it, Representative Johnson?
I'm jumping at the bed. No, I'm not here. I'm colorblind. I can't color
everything else. Well, do I have a volunteer to carry it?
I'll carry it.
Representative Doherty, thank you. Usually the person that objects to having the consent calendar is the one carries it.
Don't
so. We'll have Representative Doherty carry the bill. So, with that, did I close the work session on this? I'll close the work session on House Bill 2824. And let's open up a work session on House Bill 2978. Bob, a brief description, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2978 is the measure that authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services or Municipal Building Inspector to assess investigative fees, increase plan review fees or building permit fees if a person commences a project work without required plan review and makes additional changes. Mr. Chair, there is a Dash 1 amendment which replaces the measure, and I believe we have someone here to speak to. Or do we not?
Yes, we do. We should have somebody come up because we have a couple of questions. Welcome, Mr. Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, excuse me, my name is Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. You should have Dash 1 amendments in front of you. This bill, the Dash 1s replaced the entire bill. There was a drafting error as we were working with industry on this. Just to give a little bit of background to the committee, You may recall that we adopt the codes at the state of Oregon. They're statewide standards. We have 7 boards that we work with. We license many of the subcontractors. Those boards and contractor licensing laws are contained in individual statutes spread amongst the building codes division. The main purpose of this bill is to take many of the enforcement areas that we have in parts of those program areas or board areas and make it consistent across all of them. I'd be happy to kind of walk you through some of the areas where there would be a change to a particular board or particular industry quite quickly if you'd like.
I had one question and it popped up from somebody else as well. So we'll probably just go to the questions. There was some concern that the property owners wouldn't be able to perform work on their own property as a result of passage of this bill.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't aware of that question. I can't imagine that that changes anything related to property owners. My technical expert, Andre Simmons, with me, who runs this program area.
Answer to the chair, this bill does not change any of the licensing requirements that are currently in place. And so while there are some restrictions for commercial property owners to work on their own business, those remain in place. They're there today, with or without the bill.
So I guess a follow-up question. So as a homeowner, I could replace light switches and do my own wiring on my home if I wanted to repair something.
You're not encouraged to.
Yes, sir.
Do I have to get a permit? No, I'm not suggesting that.
Well, I'm not saying maybe that was the wrong question. I'm allowed to. I mean, whether I can or not.
Add on your sales.
Mr. Chair, you'd still have to get a permit to check your work as well.
Yeah, I'd still be required to get a permit. So that was one of the concerns I had, and I know it popped up with somebody else as well. So thank you for that clarification. Other questions? Rep. Sim Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, is there anything that I, as a independent contractor, licensed contractor, should be concerned about in this new bill? Is it going to make my life more difficult? Is it going to ensure that somehow there's a level playing field for everyone? What's my take home to tell my folks on the home front about this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, from your perspective, those individuals who have appropriate licenses, get permits before they construct, there's not going to be any impact to them. For those individuals who do not do that, there will be an impact to them. In some cases, there isn't an impact because if you took out a boiler permit, which I wouldn't believe that you would, or an elevator permit, there isn't a provision for a double permit fee. There's no incentive for you to get the permit first, and we think there ought to be. So hopefully I've answered your question.
Okay.
This is about making consistent across the various boards I have, the current authority we have, making sure that we have the ability to create that incentive for folks to buy the permits to begin with, and then deals with an area later on in the bill where we've had problems with folks getting into the business. They have their license suspended or conditioned or revoked. They come back in as maybe a different business name, different entity. It's the same person, same sets of problems. We catch them. Then they come back and it's a relative or a family member, and then we catch that person, and we're trying to kind of close that out with this bill as well across our programs. We've been able to do it in some of the areas. Again, I run licensing in electrical, plumbing, boiler, and elevator, and manufactured housing are the areas that I regulate.
Follow up then.
Follow up.
This won't change really anything that happens at the county building level, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it does not, other than it gives them the same tools that we have.
Right. Thank you.
Did you want to answer?
It does give them the
same. Other questions?
Yes, you want to comment?
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Respectfully, Chair.
And could you identify yourself? I'm not sure you did.
Sure, Representative Hulvey. For the record, my name is Andrea Simmons, and I'm the Enforcement Manager for Building Codes. And if I may, Chair, to further answer Representative Johnson's question, the other thing, as a licensee who's gone through all the processes, had the proper licensing, another safeguard that may be there that's a take-home maybe for your folks is that currently in some code, especially because, for example, electrical and plumbing, there's a 5-day period for which you have to get a permit if you started something on the weekend because of an emergency situation, but it's not across all of the different programs. So this bill also provides that protection to the contractors, independent or otherwise, that if for some reason they get a call on a holiday on the weekend to do something, a structure collapse, and they want to begin work without the permit, they can, as long as they go get that permit and approval within 5 business days.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, share with me, what would Brett Cook say about this bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Well, I hope as a billing official, Brett would support it. I haven't talked to him, though, and he hasn't shared with me that he has any concerns. Just to help. This is a bill that was brought to you by our coalition of industry folks to who work across those boards areas, and we work closely with them. So I assume Brett's aware, but I have not talked to him about this bill. If you'd like, I would be happy to.
No, I just want to make sure. And this is an area that's new to
Brett,
me. I just want to make
Brett
sure.
Works in the representative's area.
Yeah, he's our building guy, and I just want to make sure he would be good with this.
I would assume that he is, but since I haven't talked to him, I'm a little hesitant
right.
to speak.
All right,
folks.
Unfair question to you. Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Richardson.
Thank you. I'd like to direct your attention to the fee aspects of it on page 1, where it says that an investigative fee, an increased plan review fee, and building permit fees at the time of permits may be charged, and they may not total more than twice the amount of the plan review fee and the building permit fees. When I'm dealing with people, when they start seeing multiple fees and a restriction that's not going to double the fees, they get a little nervous. And so can you explain what that is really saying as far as the cost of doing work on a project?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, under current law in the all of the areas except for plumbing, boiler, and elevator, so you're talking, again, I run 7 boards, multiple programs, multiple codes, and so they're all just a little bit different because it's a relic of having individual statutes. Under the structural program and the residential program, right now, if you were to work without a permit or a plan review for some reason you chose to just do work without, and the building inspector catches you, his choice is one of several things. First is to put an enforcement action with us where we could then put you through some type of action that has $1,000 minimums or $5,000 maximums or fail to get there, it's fairly delayed. Or he could do nothing, or he could charge you a double permit fee. That's done at the administrative level, and that's done currently. What this bill does is carry those out to those other programs that don't have that piece, which we think creates the incentive for folks to get the permit and the plan review before they start work. Hope I've answered your question.
You have. Where does it apply currently, and where would it apply after this is passed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it applies currently in the structural program, the mechanical program. So when you get a structural permit or mechanical permit, in the residential program, and in the electrical program. It's not as clear in the plumbing program, the boiler program, the elevator program, and the manufactured housing program. Going off the top of my head from my notes, I believe that is the way it is currently. So this makes it across the board consistent within my organization and at the local government level.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I'm not seeing any. Have we adopted the amendment yet on this?
No, I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lively, can we have a motion to adopt the amendment?
Sure. Chair Hovey, I move the adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 2978, dated 2/25/13.
Representative Lively moves the adoption of the -1 amendment to House Bill 2978, dated 2/25/13. Any discussion about adopting the amendment? Any objection?
Just slowing down the conversation just slightly.
Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had so many questions afterwards. I can't remember exactly what the dash one was supposed to do. What was that addressing specifically, just in a sentence or two? Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Thatcher, it's a complete rewrite of the bill.
Yeah, rewrite. Oh my God.
And I apologize. I
did
we're not going to be passing the bill today.
Thank you. Yeah, that was what I was panicking about.
I'd like to give people a little more opportunity.
Yeah, you don't have to go into this. Thank you. I just needed to make sure.
Just wanted to get the amendment adopted so we can get the paperwork in order to eventually vote on it, hopefully, before the end of our timelines. Any objection to adopting the amendment or any other discussion? no objections, we'll adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2978, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2978. And as you're leaving, Mr. Long, it might be useful to provide, I think you had a chart that kind of showed the uniformity that you were creating with this bill. It might be useful, I think, for the some of the committee members to see that. It might be helpful. With that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2821. Bob, give us a brief description of the bill and what we're looking at for amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2821 extends the time period in which reasonable and necessary expenses must be covered by personal injury protection benefits, changes the damages used in calculating reimbursement owed to a provider of personal injury protection benefits. The committee has before it a Dash 2 amendment, and we have folks here to speak to that Dash 2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Rob Dalton and Neil Jackson. Good afternoon, and if you'd introduce yourself before you speak on the record, and if I recall, we did talk about the subject of the Dash 2 amendments at our first public hearing on this bill, so if you could describe the Dash 2 amendments for us briefly, that would be helpful.
I certainly will. My name's Rob Dalton. Greetings, Chairman Holvey and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here today to explain these changes in the law to you. I've been a personal injury attorney representing the victims of car accidents for about 30 years now. The last 20 years has been in the Clackamas area. House Bill 2821 is designed to fix a very serious problem with the laws related to underinsured motorist claims. And I'm going to refer to those as UIM claims now just to speed it up, and that's also the way we describe it within our business. Let's try to be clear. UIM issues only arise in very significant injury cases. These are claims with broken bones, injuries that require surgery, injuries with permanent life-changing consequences. Often, virtually all the time in these cases, the victim incurs very large medical bills, huge medical bills in many cases. A victim only has a UIM claim if the full policy limit of the wrongdoer, the person who caused the accident, has already been paid. That's very important because the problem with the current law is it keeps people from getting what they paid for. Specifically, when you buy an insurance policy, it contains a bunch of different provisions. There's a provision for payment of medical bills up to a certain policy limit under PIP. There's a provision for payment of wage reimbursement, and there's a provision under the UIM portion of the policy that provides a certain benefit. Accident victims only get to access the UIM portion of their policy if it is greater, this is under current law, if that limit is greater than that of the wrongdoer. So for example, in my written materials you'll see that if a person bought an insurance policy for $50,000 as their basic per person policy limit, and the defendant, the wrongdoer, only had a $25,000 policy. Once the victim had obtained consent from the adverse insurance company to pay that policy limit, they would then be able to initiate a UIM claim against their own insurance policy, but only for the difference 25 versus 50, only for the additional 25,000. The problem with that is many times the bills are far, far in excess of the available proceeds from all policies. So even if a person meets the requirement, the prerequisite, that they have satisfied and gotten the policy limit from the other insurance company, from the adverse insurance company, they still are unable to get an additor. They're unable to obtain the full benefit of their own insurance policy, even when benefits far exceed, even when their injuries and the damages, therefore, far exceed the available proceeds. I have a chart over here that hopefully will make it a little bit clearer. If you'll refer to the what we've described over there as current law, you'll see two bars. And those two bars represent the insurance policy of the defendant in blue and the insurance policy of the plaintiff in green. The medical bills, in this case, this example, are $75,000. Current law only allows no benefit from the UIM portion of the victim's policy. That's what's shown under current law. You can see that since they equal each other, since they're both 25, there's absolutely no ability to access that portion of the policy that the victim purchased, even though their medical bills in and of themselves, discounting all other forms of damages, far exceed that part. I believe that the current law basically puts a minus sign, if you think about it, in every case, and it applies regardless of the actual damages. So in this case, and that current law example that we have over there, 25 on one side, 25 on the other, subtract the two, absolutely no benefit. House Bill 2821 proposes that in appropriate cases, we turn that minus sign into a plus sign. What that would do in our example on the chart is it allows the victim to add, instead of a minus sign, we're putting a plus sign. It allows them to add the benefit that was available under their own policy, the UIM benefit of $25,000, to the $25,000 obtained from the defendant or wrongdoer's insurance policy, producing a benefit of $50,000. Interestingly enough, if you look at the chart, you'll see that even when you add those two together, in this example, it does not total even the total amount of the medical bills. So we're not talking about creating a situation where there's an unjust enrichment. We're talking about the serious injury cases with life-changing injuries and giving the victim of that accident the benefit of what they paid for. They paid a premium to get a UIM benefit. Under today's law, if you ponder on it for a second, you will see that at a minimum limit situation, there's no scenario under which a person could ever be able to have a situation where they would be able to access their UIM policy. The other guy is going to have at least 25. If they only have 25, the best it's ever going to be is a match. That's a minus sign. No benefit available.
So can I stop you there for just a second? So what happens to, considering that Representative Lively was at fault and he has this liability insurance in the green and I'm in the blue, I get paid $25,000 in this scenario. What happens to the green amount? Because he's paying for, I would assume, what's required for some sort of liability in case he runs into somebody and it's his fault. What happens to that green amount?
Well, if I understand the question, the green amount is obtained by the victim of the accident and is used to apply towards their lost wages, their medical bills, any
under current law.
However, there's no access to the victim's own policy, to your own policy, so there is only an ability to obtain that one policy limit and no ability to obtain any benefit under the UIM portion of the...
So the premiums that I'm paying for my policy then just stay with the insurance company?
That's right. It's a windfall to the insurance company. That brings up kind of my next point, which is that you're going to hear from some representative of insurance companies today. They may well claim that premiums will skyrocket if they're forced to allow their policyholders to collect the UIM benefits that they've already paid for. I submit that this simply is not true. In Washington, stacking has been allowed, and that's what we're talking about here, is putting one policy on top of another in cases where there are very serious injuries, very serious bills, huge damages. Washington's allowed stacking for many, many years. The sky has not fallen. The premium rates in Washington are basically equal. And so it is just not true that there will be a dramatic impact on premiums. What there will be a dramatic impact on is people's lives. In Mr. Jackson's testimony, he'll be telling you about a lady who was in a horrendous accident out near Madras, had enormous...
We really need to wrap up, and so I think you've described described the scenario of the Dash 2 amendment for us, and Mr. Jackson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and try to be as concise as we can. We have a few other things on the agenda yet.
I saw that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 2821. I want to speak specifically to, there's a woman in Portland named Daylene McElhaney. She is a widowed mother of two. She is an elementary teacher in the Park Rose District. She's teaching right now. Otherwise, she would be down here or she would be on the phone. But she can't come down. She asked me to come down and tell you her story. You have pictures in the packets that were sent to you. We wanted to show you some of her story, and I'm briefly going to outline what happened. In October 30th of 2011, she was driving back from Madras. She had taken her children to a swim meet, and she was a widowed mother at that time. She got in a horrible accident 4 miles outside of Madras. Another car came over the center lane. It was a head-on collision. You can see the pictures of the cars. Mrs. McElhaney and her children were in the van, the red van. They're in the pictures. The other vehicle is shown. It's not shown in the pictures, but I can tell you from reviewing the reports that the motor from the other vehicle was found 148 feet from the scene of the impact. That's how hard the impact was. She was transported. She suffered very serious injuries. She was transported to the Madras Hospital. They could not handle the severity of her injuries. She was then taken to St. Charles in Bend, where she underwent surgery. She spent 9 days and nights in St. Charles. She was then transported to Good Samaritan, where she spent 14 nights. She is, as she describes, a bionic woman. She has a plate in her left hip, rod in her left femur, rod in her right tibia, and multiple screws. You can see the x-rays. This was a very severe injury. She said she doesn't even have to go through the airport security. She lights it up when she walks up close to it. That's how much metal she's got into her. After that, she spent 10 months of physical therapy, and she describes it as excruciatingly painful. She was 4 months in a wheelchair. She was on a walker for a couple of weeks, 9 months on crutches, and 4 months on a cane before she could walk without the use of any other device. She had to move back in with her parents because of the impact on her and her ability to work, because obviously she couldn't work. She was working part-time at the time of the accident. She was teaching English. Fortunately, her school was able to work her a full-time job, which is what she's doing now. She teaches kindergarten at Park Rose Elementary. She found out when she got everything collected, she had $285,000 in medical bills from these horrific injuries. She had paid for a good policy. Her policy had $100,000 underinsured motorist coverage that she had paid premiums for. The other driver had a good policy, $100,000 in liability coverage. She assumed that because she had underinsurance coverage and the other driver had $100,000 in liability coverage, she would have at least $200,000 to pay this $285,000 bill. No. She went to see a lawyer. The lawyer explained, no, under current law, you only get $100,000. You do not get access to your UIM coverage that you have paid for because your $100,000 is the same as the other party's $100,000. Therefore, the insurance company keeps your premiums. They don't have to pay anything. So she had $100,000 to pay $285,000 worth of medical bills. This bill is pure stacking, just like Washington has. She would have had access to that money if this bill is passed, if the Dash 2 amendments are passed. She now says she's 75% to 80% better. She can't go upstairs with two steps using both legs. She goes up one step at a time. But she's going on with her life. She lives with her parents. Her children live, they all live together, and thank God for her parents, is how she put it. Just a couple of points I want to raise, because the opponents are going to say this is going to send premiums through the roof. I would remind the members of the committee who were there, Mr. Chairman, that back in 2009, we introduced bills to double the PIP wage claim that was being paid under the statute, and to double the coverage for property damage. We were told at that time that skyrocketing rates would result because we were doubling two coverages that you all buy. It didn't happen. In 2009, before the Senate and House Judiciary Committee, there was a bill introduced that was passed, which changed the limits that could be claimed by consumers and still get attorney's fees on smaller claims. At that time, the insurance industry representatives testified that 90% of their cases were $10,000 or less that they had to pay out. So that means that less than 10% of the cases that they have to deal with what we're talking about today. And it's a lot less than 10%. You're only talking about the cases where somebody is catastrophically injured and they have huge bills. And those bills are not getting paid. People are moving in with their parents. The state is picking up the cost. The taxpayers are picking up the cost. And this pure stacking is what our brothers and sisters in Washington have. The sky is still up, last time I looked.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. I can understand your passion on this. Okay. And appreciate your testimony. I appreciate the understanding of what the Dash 2 does. Are there any questions from the committee on this? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question, but I'm not sure who to ask it to. In Section 1, there's a couple definitions, and I just need assurance that the definition of motor vehicle is a standard definition that we use throughout ORS.
Yes, it doesn't change the definition.
We haven't created a definition of that.
Because it's tied into the financial responsibility law. It's the same definition.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up? Thank you. And then on line 18 and 19 of page 1, where it talks about farm-type tractors and self-propelled equipment, is that again standard?
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't change any of the definitions of motor vehicles.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. So we're under work session. Representative Lively, a motion on the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, Chair Hovey, I move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2821, dated 3-22-13.
Representative Lively moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2821, dated 3-22-13. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I do have an answer, or a question, not an answer. That's my problem. Mm-hmm. Now, originally we've been talking about, it's just a matter of a question on terminology. We've been talking about PIP insurance, and mm-hmm. now we're talking about underinsured motorist UIM. And I'm just not real clear. Is this amendment changing from PIP to underinsured motorist?
No, I don't believe so. Representative Richardson might be able to answer that with more definitive answer.
Separate issues, really. The PIP is kind of no-fault medical coverage. Underinsured motorists, originally the idea was you need to have something in your policy in case the other guy has no insurance at all. And so we have minimums and so forth. And if they have no insurance at all, then you get that coverage. But what has been found is in a certain minority of the cases, the damages are really extreme. You've been paying the premiums on the on this uninsured motorist coverage. And so in other states like Washington, they've said because you've been paying the premiums, if you have extravagant, you know, serious injuries, catastrophic injuries, then you can take your uninsured motorist coverage and put it on top of the coverage that the other side has. Where presently, if your coverage is equal to or less than, then you get zero. This would allow you to have the benefit of the premiums that you've been paying for that coverage in a catastrophic loss situation.
I guess what my question is, are we adding UIM rather than, because the discussion, I think, all along has been PIP.
This is a separate, so, this
okay,
is an additional
that's what I need to know.
Change on the insurance law. You know, we have PIP under the underlying, and then this is also...
So it's PIP and UIM now with this amendment. Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions for Representative Johnson?
Can I hear from anyone in the industry about the Dash 2s or what it does to actually 2821? Hour later, I just... Are you planning to...
I wasn't planning on it, but we could if you want.
Would you like... curious to get feedback.
Would Sean Miller or John Powell like to come up?
Love to. You'd love to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in opposition to House Bill 2821. We did provide information of the cost impacts on the PIP side. To answer Representative Thatcher's question on UIM, this is a new issue to this bill that we just saw right before the hearing. I don't even have the amendment, so I'd love to comment other than based on the stacking argument. I just, we told the committee about the impact on costs. Obviously, we believe this will raise costs. I think the proponents obviously point to Washington, and all we can say is, you know, we are comparing apples to oranges when we compare to Washington. Mm-hmm. There's different level of requirement coverages, which are lower in Washington. PIP is not a required coverage in Washington. So to say cost impacts comparative to Washington, you just can't do that. And it's hard for us to do that in any state. And so I just want to point that out to the committee. And again, I don't know when the amendment was released. I didn't have it, so we don't have an analysis for the committee.
Yeah. It's been up on our system for quite a while.
I'm not saying it could be our fault. I'm just saying it didn't happen.
Powell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Mutual. The chart that you see there is accurate in that it shows the potential of recovery. What it doesn't show is how premiums are developed in insurance. The standalone coverages that were adopted under the no-fault system in the early 70s make these required coverages, and one of the goals of that effort in that era of no-fault insurance, which eventually didn't come to pass totally, and we just have this portion of quote no-fault, is a methodology of protecting yourself and the passengers in your car in case somebody with low limits hits you. You buy higher limits, you're protected by that difference. It turns into underinsured motorists, meaning the other person was underinsured in your belief. But the premium for each category is based on claims. It's not based on some fiction. It's based on actual claims information that actuaries use to develop the need for a premium for each box. Mm-hmm. And if you stack them on top of each other, they will just have to increase that premium by that amount. I can't tell you what that amount would be because we haven't had an actuary look at this. But the fact is, that's how it's priced. Mm-hmm. So if you double the recovery, you have to have more premium to pay those bills. And that's just a simple fact of life. And that's how they're established. They're not mythical. They're actually based on claims data. And so when you increase the claims, it's like a budget down in ways and means. If more people are going to recover from a certain pot, you have to have more in the pot.
And I understand your position on that. Are there other questions? Representative Thatcher.
And maybe I should have asked the previous panel instead, but I remember hearing last, during the last hearing, that PIP, we weren't talking about underinsured motorists at that point, that PIP insurance is just a small fraction of an overall cost of auto insurance premium. And so if that goes up even double, that really wouldn't, that's my takeaway, that it wouldn't really affect the overall premium all that much because it's such a small portion. However, yesterday I was having a discussion with a constituent who happens to be an insurance agent, and she was not here to talk to me about this bill. I was simply asking her about it. And she mentioned that that the PIP insurance has been a major driver in the cost of insurance today, and that even though people aren't necessarily dropping their coverage, that they are maybe going to low liability coverage places, just because it reduces the amount of premium they would have to pay, not dropping their insurance altogether. But anyway, so that was her concern. So there'd be more underinsured motorists, really, if costs are impacted by the PIP. And I don't know what's true, because I've heard both things. It either will cause a rate increase, and then on the other hand, people say, don't worry about it, it's not going to cause a rate increase. I'm not sure what to think at this point. So,
thank you. Well, you have a motion, and we're rounding up our time limit, so I'd like to we have made the motion.
Mm-hmm. Just right, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote yes on the amendment, but I'm still out on the bill in its entirety.
Okay. Thank you. So Representative Lively, I'll restate, has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 2821, dated 3/22/13, and we've had discussion. And I sense there's probably some objection. Is there objection to the amendment, adopting the amendment? Representative Thatcher, Representative Johnson, so noted. The -2 amendments are adopted. And it's my intent to go ahead and move this bill. So, Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move that House Bill 2821, as amended, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2821 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Bingham-Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Richardson?
Aye.
Mr.
Holby? Aye. House Bill 2821, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. Representative Richardson, would you care to carry this one? Or that looked like a big sigh. So the chair will carry this one, unless there's another volunteer. Seeing none, I'll carry the bill. So
I'll carry the bill.
Well, it's up to you.
I'll carry them. If there's questions, you get to.
Okay, well, yeah. Okay, Representative Richardson will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2821. And, Bob, do we have anything that's uncontroversial left to do? House Bill 2823. I think we got just about 3 or 4 minutes. Bob, give us. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2823.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2823 is the measure that establishes requirements for association accounts of planned community homeowner associations and condominium unit owners associations. The committee has before it a -2 amendment, and we have an individual here to speak to that -2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
And can she come up and speak in 2 minutes to, because you've already spent a lot of time on the bill before, and so briefly, what does the amendment do to the bill, please?
I'll do it in 1:45.
Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. I'm here today representing the Joint Working Group on this bill. I testified before the committee March 25th about this bill, and the Dash 1 amendments were technical amendments to the bill, and the Dash 2 amendments take the Dash 1 amendments and take out four different sections of them. The only change to the bill from the Dash 2 is to take out the to leave the statute as is, where planned community homeowners associations and condominium associations can only have the money held in FDIC-insured banks. That's the current statute. The what was in the Dash 1 amendments was to also allow, it was a new concept, to allow them to have it in with Oregon broker-dealers and SIPC accounts. Based on Dave Tapman's letter that he sent to the committee stating that SIPC insurance is real different than FDIC insurance, and that he felt that that may create greater risk to associations, the Joint Working Group decided to ask that that language be taken out. So that's the change.
Thank you. It was a pretty simple change to the original bill. So I thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, before we start,
Representative Lively,
I just want to declare I may have a conflict of interest because I'm an owner of Eagle Crest.
We won't be voting the bill out today, okay. So you can practice that.
I'll get the one in writing done then. Okay.
So with that, can we adopt the amendment, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move that the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2823, dated 4/13 be adopted.
Representative Lively moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2823 be adopted, dated 4/13. Discussion about this particular piece? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2823. And, Bob, I believe we're out of time for the newspapers, and we're going to have to carry that one over. So we will carry over House Bill 2822, House Bill 2929. Which other ones are we carrying over? And House Bill 2207 and House Bill 2978. And House Bill 2662 all be carried over. So with that, we'll adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.